Hi, my name is Kevin Bazan.
And I'm Ricky.
And today we'll be talking about 2001, A Space Odyssey, directed by Stanley Kubrick.
Yep, we got some big questions here, so I'll read off the first one. It's got a few different parts.
Yep.
The first one is, what form will advanced or alien life forms most likely take? What is the next most logical step in evolution? Will the creatures we may one day encounter be biological life forms, machines, or beings of pure energy?
That's a lot of questions.
It is a lot of questions. Let's start.
Which one like piques your interest the most?
Let's just go in order. Let's take on the first part of this question.
I think we should just say, like, to me, I think, like, we will see, like, humanoid robots. I don't believe in, like, aliens and, like, a new biological species besides us. I feel like as medical advances go on, there would just be, like, you know, certain humanoid parts, or even, like, transfer our brains into, like, an AI, like, system, like, into a computer. Like,
yeah,
I think the closest thing that we would get to
might be replacing biological, because you already see, like, the beginnings of that, like, prosthetics.
Yeah.
And the advancements that prosthetics are making. Like, they're not just, like, it's not, like, it's easier to, like, control your prosthetics now, I guess, with more technology as it goes on. But I don't feel like you could transfer consciousness into, like, a computer, because that's, like, something, you're taking, like, a part of, like, who you are, and you're trying to transfer it into a computer. I don't think that's realistic. But I will agree with you on the part where there's no, like, other biological life forms.
Like, think about it. Like, you get, like the brain has, like, electricity inside of it, like, protons and neutrons.
Yeah.
And, like, you can, like, go ahead and get, like, a link cable and, like, put it through, like, a desktop computer.
That is not how electricity through the brain works. The brain's electricity is firing through all of your muscles, not the type that you simply plug into an outlet. If you were to plug in an outlet into your brain, you'd die.
Your being
is somebody that is something that, like what makes you you. It's not really like a computer can only intake, like, inputs, right? Mm-hmm. A bunch of ones and zeros.
Okay.
That's not your brain.
Okay.
A computer can't comprehend the vastness of the human mind.
You're right. So we can all agree that the next step for, like, a new species is, like, prosthetics and, you know, body replacements, or, like, even changing, like, a biological human into, like, a robot because of, like, you know, like, medical purposes, per se. So,
yeah.
Okay. And so what would you say? Is it a new biological life form?
Machines.
A machine. Yeah.
And for the question where it says, what form will advanced or alien life forms most likely take? I mean, I think we both can agree that we don't think that they exist, right? But if they were to, right? Let's change to if they were to exist, what do you think they would be?
It would just be something bizarre and different, I think. Or it can be something with, like, it would be like a human biological body with a different color or skin.
Because I would say there's, like, basic things that you would have to have, like, basic, like, function, right? So you would have to have a design similar to the human.
Yeah.
Right? Because we work, right? Us humans, we work. We got a brain, we got limbs that work consecutively. You get what I mean,
yes.
Right?
Yeah.
And, it all works together. So to stray too far away from that basic outline, you would be drastically changing, like, the function. So if I think it would be any higher life, maybe just a different form of humans. Maybe humans that have more adaptability, instead of needing, like, a coat or something, there's something, like, built into their bodies, I guess.
So probably something different internally, like the different, the body system.
Like lung capacity, being able to, like, run faster, have the ceiling of all of, like, the normal human things. But just higher.
What about externally, like the physical makeup of? Would it be, like, exactly
just
us, or maybe an extra organ, an extra nose, an extra nostril,
something like that? Like, if you needed it,
okay.
Like, if whatever planet they come from requires that evolutionary track, then you would.
That's the question that can open up new territories. But just to generalize it, it has to be. I think the requirements for a new, like, life being would be something new that's out of the norm of a human body on Earth.
Yeah.
Okay. And then for the next question number two. Wait, did we finish those three questions?
The only one we didn't answer was what is next most logical step in evolution? I think we kind of answered that in the other two questions.
Did.
But we'll just go over it one more time. I think the next step would be like basic functions of a human, but better. So like better eyesight, more lung capacity, and just overall just enhancing among the basic functions rather than like growing an extra arm or something like that.
Yeah, same thing, but for me, I would change it into medical cases. So, All right, next set of questions. Should we pursue contact with other life forms or should we adopt a more isolationist approach? Explain your reasoning. I'll let you answer this one.
I think we should try to see and explore what's out there. Like, if there is something out there, there's a lot to learn from having that. And so we should, like, probably do our best to, like, uncover the secrets because, like, the universe is made up of, like, basic, like, to our knowledge, there's, like, a set amount of, like, basic elements in the world, right?
Yeah.
But if we go out, we find a new one. And we find out we can create it here, and that can lead to more advancements. So I think that we should keep exploring, in my opinion.
We should, but, like, how are we going to do it? Like, I mean, like, I know we got SpaceX doing, like, commercial flights, but how are we going to go ahead and, like, do it? Like, are we going to go ahead and exceed, like, something bigger, like, to the point we can go ahead and hyperspeed into different, like, galaxies? Because, like, I think we have to explore really far into space if we want to find something new.
I mean, obviously that's going to take time and, and trying to explore, but I feel like we've come this far with technology. Like, there was always those people that said, oh, it's good, such and such is going to be impossible. Like in Star Trek, it was considered science fiction where they had the watches and the communicators. We got those now, Apple watches.
You're right.
We got like those advanced technologies that seem so in the far in the future. But that's like the great thing about the human mind. I think one of the reasons why, gonna kind of get sidetracked here, but one of the reasons why AI can never truly replace the human mind is like that growth of like innovation, I guess.
Okay. So do you think it's going to be something that's going to happen in our generation, or is it going to be happening, like, along the way?
No,
like,
long time.
Okay.
And innovation still, like this takes time.
Okay.
I do see, I learned in my physics class that there was people that wanted to learn about, like, the magnetic poles of the north, of the Earth.
Mm-hmm.
So they took basically little tops and they shot them into space. And they was doing research just to find out, like, basically, and prove a former theory about magnetism in which you can use that for more scientific advancements. That took 20 years.
Okay.
So as you can see, like even the small things take such amounts of pouring time and work. The original three people that came up with the idea, only two of them made it out alive.
Really?
Or one of them. One of them was only the only one that was there to actually see the rocket take off. So both the two, because it started in like college amongst three guys, only one of them was alive to see it, sadly. But yeah, it's just stuff like that. It takes time. It takes way too much time.
Yeah.
So not in our lifetime. Not even in the next generation either.
For sure. Not even in the next generation. Okay. Yeah. I think I gotta agree with you on this one. I think we should just grow and expand. But I mean, I think the only fear I have is just like the conflicts that can happen, you know? Like, what if we might get, like, I don't know, I might be in, like, a Star Wars mindset, but, like, I feel like we might get into, like, bad territory and might, like, have conflicts with things.
We'll be fine. Listen, if we advance technology enough to fly out all the way over there, bro, you bet we're clapping cheeks.
Okay.
We're clapping cheeks.
You're that confident, aren't you?
Oh, yeah, easy.
Okay.
Human race, best life form.
Okay.
That's not racism, that's speciesism, but okay.
Let's stop that. Okay. Last set of questions. I'll let you read these ones.
Alright. If we do encounter an alien race, either in space or here on Earth, how will that contact make us feel about ourselves as a species? Will it change the way we view ourselves and our place in the universe? What are the most likely human reactions to knowledge that we are not alone? So that first question, going back to what I said earlier, human power, you know, we're awesome.
Yeah.
We're cool. We can handle it. I feel like just our general innovation and ability to grow is going to put us, like, over the top in terms of, like, encountering other races. I feel pretty confident.
You think so?
Yeah.
I think that statement you made was kind of like fudge nuggets. It's kind of like, it's like trying to, like, it's segregating the other race. Like, it feels like you're kind of having, like, a closed mindset of, like, the other person, like,
well,
like,
no, I'm just saying that we won't get, like, demolished. Okay. Like, I'm not saying, like, everybody else is stupid, more as we're just, like, we're just good.
Okay.
Like, imagine, like, we build the technology to, like, go into light speed. Like, just for an example, right? Mm-hmm. We build that technology. I think, like, we'll be set. Because, like, if you imagine it, we would be the first ones to
do. Do you think?
Because if they came up with technology, they might run into us first. Mm-hmm. And it's like a race. Whoever gets there first.
Yeah.
And at the rate, like, the human mind grows, I feel like we're pretty confident in not getting run over by another person. I'm not saying we should run over other people, of course.
Mm-hmm. So, for, like, I'm going to make up a scenario. If we do encounter an alien race, right? How would like the world like react to it? I know the government will go ahead and like capture this like thing, right?
Yeah, easy. I would feel like there's a lot of like fear in the unknown. Like that's one of the biggest like human like traits, I guess, is the fear of the unknown. Like if you don't know something, it's like natural instinct to be cautious of it.
Yeah.
So when you're encountering something new and you're worried that like, hey, it's either me or them, you're gonna like, I know that there's a lot of people that on instinct will just say, okay, well, me first, we might as well attack them because they came here and we're kind of scared, that kind of thing.
Okay. So like, that's a good point, but I think just like a discovery of like a species would cause the world, it would surprise the whole world, and then it would go ahead and be like, oh man, we gotta go ahead and capture this thing like ASAP. You know how like the Cold War with like Russia and the US? It might be like more of like all the countries or like all the continents in the world like to capture this thing.
And I also feel like if there was like an extraterrestrial life, there would have to be some like some working together with the countries of the world. You can't like split that. So like let's say it lands in the US or it lands in England or something. Mm-hmm. Like the rest of the world's gonna want to know about that. I feel like that's something that you should share.
You should.
And
okay.
I feel like, you know, there is like a possibility through fear of using it as weaponized to like push over other countries. It might be kept as a secret, you know, like let's say like something crashes in England, they put over a cover up.
Yeah.
We don't know about it. We don't know that they found some alien tech.
Okay.
Right.
So I think that would cause a lot of conflict.
It would.
So.
And they'd be on top because they'd have all the alien technology, assuming they're. Like they got here first.
So in order to prevent like world conflict and even conflict with the species and their world, I think we would have to keep this as open like as possible.
Oh yeah, definitely.
To keep things under contain.
Be like, hey, you know, we're not out to hurt anybody.
Yeah.
Welcome, I guess.
Yeah. Okay. Be welcoming and okay. All right. What other things?
Will it change the way that we view ourselves and our place in the universe? I guess if we don't know we're the only ones, we feel not as special.
Yeah.
Because it's like, out of all of the planets, you know, Earth is the only one with life. And then somebody comes along and says, actually, no. And let's say in the part where they get here first, we've already developed, like, transportation through this, this, and this.
Yeah.
And we've discovered a whole other element.
Yeah.
What have you been doing? What? Half-working prosthetic legs, bro, we came up with that, like, eons ago. Get on our level, basically.
Yeah.
Like, that kind of thing. Like, when somebody comes along and says, hey, you're not special, we did it better, kind of makes you feel kind of crappy.
It would make us want to go ahead and, like, compete with the other race.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
Species.
My bad.
Very different.
The human reaction that we're not alone, it's going to be a 50-50. It's like, man, that's total bull.
Yeah. To be honest, it all depends on what person you're asking.
Yeah.
Like, if somebody who's, like,
a conservative that's religious, he'll say no. If it's, like, an open-minded person that believes in, like, natural, like, like data and like, you know, scientists like things and stuff like that, they'll say yes. It's vice versa.
It just depends on like whether or not you want to open your mind to something like the new possibility. Like it could break your entire reality.
Yeah.
Like there's a lot of religions that say that, oh, Earth is the only life form. So what if there's another life form?
Yeah.
That like breaks down a lot of what you built it around. And there are some sometimes, and like understandably so, like when what you put so much time and faith into crumbles down around you, it's really hard to cope with.
Yeah, it's really hard to cope with that. So yeah, the reactions would be bad and good, but I think the majority would be bad.
Yeah.
So I mean, man, that was a really fun discussion.
Really was.
It was.
Had some disagreements, had some agreements.
I had my dumb moments, you had your pretty cool moments. So it's all cool. It's all we Gucci.
Yeah.
So that's our discussion, just to go ahead and make way for the next segments along the way. You wanna go ahead and just like say what we're gonna be doing for like the next segments?
The next segment we won't be doing it together.
Yeah, unfortunately.
But yeah. The next segment is probably going to be a discussion on the introduction of the movie, Part 1, The Dawn of Man.
And so forth. Like, furthermore to come. So, yeah.
Well, it was great doing this first opening segment with you.
Likewise. All right. Thank you so much. Oh, my name's Kevin.
I'm Ricky.
And next.
I'll see you next segment. See you.
Yeah, bye-bye.
Bye. Hello, and this is part one of the three-part analysis section of the 2001 Space Odyssey. Now, this is going to be the introduction part of it, and we're gonna start off with some questions here. The film is entitled 2001 A Space Odyssey. With that in mind, what is ironic about the opening scenes? What I think is that the opening scenes have like pre-man, like pre-evolutionary man, like apes and stuff like that. They're very, very primitive. And 2001 would be referring to at the time the future was made, the movie was made, the future. So the movie is supposed to be focusing on the future and the general technological advancements of man, and it starts off with the exact opposite, going way before our time, like way before, like pre-evolutionary man. And I think that it forms of kind of a like contrast, I guess. Like, it's ironic how a movie about the future starts in the past. I guess is the short and sweet best way that I could summarize that that section. Number two, describe the life led by the apes in the first few scenes. Why do they fight over the water? This one is, they live like a scarce life. Resources are very, very scarce. Food and water and just general things that they need to do are not present. So they have to scavenge, they have to pick apart scraps. They can be seen drinking from that one small water hole. And they are struggling to stay alive. And they fight over the water pool from the other apes that come because there are not that many around. So they have control over that one, and the other group comes and tries to give them the boot, like kick them out. And it's not big enough like to share. It's only big enough for one group, so they have to fight over it. The next question is, what unusual object do the apes find? What effect does it have on them? Is after they're driven out of the water hole, they are hiding in their little
den, I guess, is what you call it. And then they go out and they see a monolith. And the monolith is like the big slab of what looks to be like stone or some sort of material like that. And at first they freak out because they don't know what it is. They're screaming, they're circling around it. One of them goes to try to touch it. They're scared at first. And then one touches it and he's okay. So then they all go to touch it. And the effect that it seems to have on them is it seemed to have like gave them a push in the direction of learning the next technological advancements. Like you can see the ape who picks up the bone, it's got the flash of the monolith, and then he picks it up and starts beating the skeleton, the rest of the skeleton, with the bone that he picked up. And I think that that shot of the monolith was there to be like, or as a form of saying that them touching the monolith and then immediately after making the connection that they could use bones as weapons was not a coincidence. And I think that later on in the movie, when the monolith returns, you can see that the monolith is probably something sent out by alien life forms to encourage or trigger a evolution in humankind, like the next step of evolution. But yeah, so then the next one is, what two things does the ape learn to do with the bone? And the first one is it uses it to kill some of the other animals that it had to share the food with. It kills it and then it eats it and shows that now man is no longer vegetarians. Like they eat meat and plants. They use it to kill and hunt, I guess would be a better term for it. They use it to hunt for food, and they used it to defend their territory. They come back with the bones to and they get into a argument over the water hole again, but this time they have the more advanced technology, and they use that to kill the leader of the apes that came and took the watering hole from them so that they can take it back. And they push out the remaining other group of apes, and they use it as like kind of like a conquering tool, I guess you could call it. Kubrick cuts immediately from the bone in the air to a floating spaceship. What does this cut tell us, and what is the connection Kubrick wants us to draw between the bone and the spaceship? This one is kind of what, like what I talked about before, is the advancements of technology of man. So like back in that day, that bone was advanced technology and it was being put to use. Then you cut to outer space, seeing space station that is today's like bone, I guess you would call it. That's today's future technological advancement. And I think he wants us to connect this advancement of technology. Like, no matter how primitive using a bone as a weapon is, it was an advancement for that time. So it's not really about like the advancement of the actual technology itself, whereas taking steps going from not having something to using something to solve a problem, like needing water and resources. What does the choice of music and length of the scene tell us about how Kubrick wants to use the spacecraft in the scenes that follow? It's got sort of this grand sense, I guess, and like sense of exploration. It's really, really long to kind of emphasize the scale. Like when you're sitting and you're looking at this humongous station and you're just sitting, you can admire it. Like when you're staring at something for a long time, you kind of start to like peek at the details. And so I guess that's what he wanted us to do. And that's kind of a recurring theme, is like Kubrick leaves stuff up for interpretation and allows the person watching it to make connections. And he does, like, there are a lot of scenes that technically could be cut down shorter but aren't, and that is done on purpose, and it allows the viewer to notice things that they wouldn't otherwise notice. Like in this one, like, you can see how the top part is still being constructed and how big that part is and how long it's taking them, how the spacecraft, how the craft is spinning, and you can speculate maybe why it's spinning, for center of gravity per se, and just to show like a just greater sense of like grandness. And then in space we meet Dr. Haywood Floyd. Where is he going and what is mysterious about this place? He is heading to the moon base. And there was recently a monolith that was discovered on the moon base. And so there are speculations as to what that is, and they want information. And so that's why he's going. What are some examples of Kubrick showing audience advanced technology based on already existing machines or concepts? The video call system, where something that we kind of take for granted today, but back in the time that this was recorded, was seen as some odd, like, far off, like, advancement that was not going to happen for like a really, really long time. Like, nobody ever thought of it before. You see the Velcro shoes that are used to, that the flight, the flight attendant is using to walk over to Floyd with, so that she stays on the ground in zero gravity. You see the food trays that they're eating out of, like broken down food, so that you can, it's easily portable in space, rather than, and it doesn't rot either. You see the facial recognition of the security and voice recognition in the security part of that. Those are all just like things that Kubrick thought ahead. Throughout the space station, Kubrick inserts several recognizable brand names. Find as many as you can. For this one, oh, and why would he want to include these elements in a futuristic film? I would say he includes the brand name of the space station and the soft drink brand name. And I would say that he put these in because he wanted to, I don't know, give connections to, from the time that the movie was being recorded and this supposed future, to say that it's not, to kind of make it seem not as distant, rather than seeing it as like a whole new Earth where all of this technology existed. You can see it as, hey, it's just like my world, but with more stuff in it, I guess. If that makes any sense. Like, it's still Earth. It's still stuff that we can recognize, just with easier access to people with the video calls and things like that. How is this encounter with the monolith on the moon similar to pre-Stormic Humix experience with such an object? Well, you can see, first off, when the humans get to the monolith, the first thing they do is they're cautious. After they've dug it up, they're cautious. They put it on a base. They send four people out there. Then one person goes over to touch it, and then they all touch it. And then you see that similar shot of like making connections, and you can assume from the last time when pre-humans touched the monolith, they got a step forward into the next evolutionary line, and now you see that this time that's going to happen again. And there was like then they go to take the picture, and you get sort of like the same shot of the monolith where the sun like aligns on the top and causes like radio discourse, which causes like a cut in that from that scene to the next scene, which could also mark and it happens right as they're about to take a picture, which before there was a certain type of like respect for the monolith as something like foreign and new and something to be like revered as, like, hey, this is here for a reason, I guess. And when you go there posing in front of it to take a picture, and then conveniently right as they're about to take the picture, then the radio discourse happens, causing irritating noise in their helmets. And that is going to do it for part one, The Dawn of Man. Stay tuned for part two, The Jupiter Mission, 18 months later, where we dive in to the, I don't want to say adventures of, but the life of Dave and Frank and their HAL 9000 computer. Stay tuned for that. Hello, this is part two of the 2001 Space Odyssey podcast breakdown. Now, this section will be discussing the Jupiter mission 18 months later. So let's just go ahead and jump right into it. This part focuses on Dave Bowman, Frank Poole, and their HAL 9000 computer. How is HAL 9000 different from the computers that we have today? I would say that one of the main reasons is emotion, I guess. HAL, throughout the movie, is able to hold conversations as if you were talking to a real human. And that's something that's, like, I guess, above all, like, the main thing that would differentiate. Because we have, like, computers that have, like, voices and stuff like that. But not anything that you could really, like, have a conversation with. It more focuses on keywords and spitting out premeditated responses. But with HAL, it was like the computer had a mind of its own. And it was able to think and have worries and stuff like that. And that kind of goes into the next one is, how does HAL 9000 seem to possess human qualities? And I think that one is, connection to other human beings. Like, he was able to have worries about the mission, uphold conversation, give compliments, basic, social skills. That's probably what I would refer to it as. HAL has a social, like, connection with the crew. And you can see when he's giving the interview, just in general, the way that he talks and acts with people is how you would act with another person. It's just he's just a robot voice. It seems like a human inside of a robot, basically. And later on, you see how he is begging for his life when Dave goes to disconnect him. What concern about the mission does HAL share with Dave Bowman? I would say he's talking about the rumors about the monolith on the moon and how he's worried about all of the information that was left out. He was worried about what was going to happen in the mission and just the general thing of the unknown, I guess, about not knowing what was going on. What error does HAL detect? Describe his reaction to this discovery. He detects something wrong with one of their communicator satellite things, and it was, they could either go out, get it, and fix it, or they could wait for mission control, or they could wait for it to fail and then see what was wrong after it. Because they go out to get the part, they don't find anything, so then they make a plan to just wait it out and see what was wrong. And it turns out that they talked back to mission control, and Hal was actually incorrect about the prediction. If Hal was wrong about this prediction, what danger does that pose to the mission? I would say that if he was wrong about this discovery, it shows that there's a malfunction in his computer programming, which means that he has the potential to fail on other more, even more critical aspects of flying the ship. And if that happens when they, like for vitals or something like that, if the computer malfunctions and the computer controls most of the ship, that produces danger for all of the astronauts inside the ship. And the astronauts, Dave and Frank, actually go to, they go inside of a pod, and they talk about this concern, and that goes on to the next question, which is why do the astronauts, Frank and Dave, have a conversation inside the pod? What are they concerned about? Well, they're concerned about the malfunctioning of Hal. They're saying that if he keeps making mistakes, we're going to have to shut him down. They're worried for their safety because of his connection to all of the ship's functions. And they go inside of the pod because they don't want him to listen. Because they don't want, because Hal could hear everything going on inside of the spaceship, except for the pod. So they pick somewhere that's soundproof. What happens to Frank Poole and why? Well, turns out that Hal was reading their lips when they were having that conversation inside of the pod, and he gets whiff of them potentially trying to shut him down. So when Frank goes out to put the part back that was supposed to be malfunctioned, Hal severs his oxygen tube and he goes flying off into space. What reasons are offered by Hal for his recent behavior? He was chalking everything up to human error. He basically said it's the human's fault for this mistake that's happening, and time for me to fix it. I can't have your mistakes jeopardizing the mission. And he locks Dave outside in space after he goes to try to retrieve Frank. And when Dave must re-enter the ship, he has to do it in an unusual way. What is dangerous about this attempt? Well, first of all, he has to enter through the airlock. And what's dangerous is if he slips up, he can get sucked out into space and immediately die. Basically, that's the problem, is because there's no oxygen out in space. So he has to open the airlock, and he gets sucked into the back. He's about to get pulled in, but luckily he gets the control panel in time, turns on the airlock, the door closes, and he is now safe. What action does Dave take towards Hal? He ends up shutting him down, so he turns off all of Hal's like primary functions, because, well, he just tried to kill the humans. One information is about Hal was revealed by the pre-recorded message discovered by Dave Bowman, is that Hal had information about the monolith. It had extra information about why the mission was kept so secret. It was about the monolith on Jupiter and the connections to the one on the moon, and kind of going forward about the curiosity of like the discovery. And you can see like this monolith has been like pushing man kind of go further and further into advancements into technology. Like first they found it on the moon, so then they pushed all the way to Jupiter and to discover like the secrets of knowledge and things like that. How does Hal further reveal his emotional slash human side on this section? Please describe as many instances where he acts human. Anytime he's talking to Dave, like in the interview, he's, as I said before, he upholds the conversation, just that social skill to where it's like, it seems human. It's not like robotic set responses. He can understanding like human emotions, like giving compliments that make people feel good and stuff like that. Just think things in that sort of general, like the way he acts is very human. Of course the scene where he is dying and he is begging, saying, "I'm afraid," like fear. That's an emotion. That's a human emotion, that Hal expressed there. Like begging for his life. Like he doesn't want to die. Like if you were just like a straight up computer, it wouldn't matter. You just get shut down. But like the will to live, I guess that's like one of the ultimate signs of being a human. In your opinion, why in your opinion did Hal malfunction? I would say it could just be an error in like the coding or something, just a false diagnostic, and then because he actually had that like human emotion, he couldn't understand that he made a mistake, so he chalked it up to human error and then went on that really, really long, drastic like tangent to try to kill all of the doctors. So yeah, that is going to conclude part 2, the Jupiter mission. Stay tuned for our final part where we talk about Jupiter and beyond the infinite. Stay tuned for that. See ya. Hello, and welcome to the final part, part 3, Jupiter and Beyond the Infinite. Let's just go ahead and get right into it. What happens to Dave Bowman as he approaches the monolith in orbit around Jupiter? He goes into what's called, or what people have come to call, the Stargate, where you see the monolith and like this portal opens and he's being sucked through like time and space, and all of these like images are being flashed before him and he's traveling through it. Describe these images seen as he proceeds through on his journey. You see like distorted pictures of Earth, lights and stuff like that. Gas clouds that are symbolized like rebirth and death, like gas clouds and symbolizing sperm and fetus. And I'm not sure if this is just me, but like when you're on that topic, you can maybe say that the ship that he was riding to Jupiter on was a sperm. And there's this idea of like rebirth and advancements through technology that the movie kind of has throughout. What sort of room does Bowman end up in? He ends up in like a French kind of room with pictures of like the Renaissance, like paintings from that time. And that kind of fits in with the entire element of just technological advancements. Like you see the furniture is really nice. It's very like pristine, I guess you would call it. Astute would be another description. Who is the old man? What connection does he have to Dave Bowman, if any? I would say that he is Dave Bowman. Like, Dave Bowman is looking at himself age faster and faster and faster. And the old man, he sees himself as an old man. near the film's conclusion, the old man in bed reaches out to get another monolith. Does this object function in the same way as the previous three? Throughout the film, you constantly see every time the prehumans on the moon and right now, every time a monolith appears, they go out to touch it. And you could kind of see like matching up with the Renaissance from around the room. When the old man goes to touch it, it kind of looks like that painting on the top of the Sistine Chapel, where it's like Adam reaching out to God, and I guess that's like him saying like reaching out because he's about to die and be like, I don't get it yet, but he's about to die and he's reaching out for like to touch it, I guess, and get more information from it, because previously, whenever they touched the monolith, there was like a new technological like a push in the right direction immediately followed by that. And with that one, I see that it was kind of like it almost seemed like it was like calling him from the way that he was like reaching out and grabbing it, I guess, because it like just kind of appeared right as he was about to die. What, in your opinion, is the creature seen in the film's final images? I think that the previous thing about like rebirth and stuff like that, I think that it's Bowman. Like, he aged super fast. He reached out to touch the monolith. All the past times have been, every time the monolith happens, it was like another advancement. And I think that that creature was like, it was re he was rebirthed. Bowman was rebirthed as the next evolutionary form of humans, and now he was going back to Earth. Is this a satisfying conclusion to the film? Before, I didn't think so, but the more you analyze the movie, the more and more the ending seems like it makes sense. Like, before, it just kind of seemed, oh, some big creature in the sky, you know, no big, no, nothing really that like interesting or anything, but more, the more and more you analyze this film, the more you get out of it, I guess. And now I feel like it's a satisfying conclusion because at the very beginning, it starts off with the pre-humans going on to another form of evolution, not just technological advancements, but like, well, I mean, it was a technological advancement, but you see the pre-humans going to the regular humans in the space era. And now, as space travel has been furthered to this point where he almost reached out to these like almost ancestral beings that are out there, he touches the monolith and he's coming back rebirthed, and now he is Bowman, or this creature, he represents the next step. And I feel like that kind of just brings a first of like the circle of constant human like evolution and growth. And yeah, that's gonna do it for our four-part series. That's part three, along with the other group part. That's gonna do it for the analysis of 2001: A Space Odyssey. Great movie. I really enjoyed doing this project. Yeah, that's gonna be it. See ya.